for, in particular, 3D numerical relativity, but even certain topics in 2D or 1D, as I showed you the example of critical phenomena during the first lecture, that required adaptive mesh refinement, even in spherical symmetry. So it's a very useful technique. All finite difference based methods sort of use or will benefit from this. The other numerical method that's common in relativity are the pseudo-spectral methods. And they don't specifically use this style of adaptive mesh refinement, but there are similar ideas there, in particular the way that they decompose their domains, the domain decomposition. So the outline is, I'll just again briefly remind you why we need AMR, and then the particular flavor of algorithm that you're going to choose is sort of dictated by the properties of the solution that you're interested in. So I'll go again over the properties of the solutions to the vacuum field equations in particular. And that suggests this Bergen-Olliger, so-called Bergen-Olliger AMR after the people that initially proposed it about 25 years ago or so. Turns out to be a really nice algorithm for GR applications. There's one sort of extension to the Bergen-Olliger algorithm that's useful. Even though the last couple of days we're talking about free evolution, so you solve the constraints on an initial time, then you solve hyperbolic equations for all time. There are other approaches to solving the field equations. In particular, one's called the constrained evolution, where you solve the constraints at every time step and a subset of the evolution equations. And those techniques have worked very well in symmetry reduced situations. In principle, they could also be extended to the 3D case, but it hasn't yet been done. But in any case, in that case, you're solving coupled elliptic hyperbolic equations, and then the standard Berger and Olliger algorithm doesn't quite work. So I'll also describe briefly how you, in principle, extend Berger and Olliger to include elliptic equations. And if we have time, we probably won't. I'll just describe this one package that implements Berger and Olliger AMR. There's several packages out there. This is sort of a problem where if you're going to use AMR, it's worth it to investigate what's out there already. It's not that it's such a complicated algorithm, but there's a little bit of, there's no point reinventing the wheel if there are things that are out there. And so the particular package that I use is PAMR, AMRD, Parallel Adaptive Mesh Refinement and Adaptive Mesh Refinement Driver. And if we have time, I'll sort of briefly describe that. And it's freely downloadable from Matt's webpage. He sort of maintains the software distribution. The documentation isn't great. It's sort of a research quality tool, but there is some documentation for it online. Okay, so adaptive mesh refinement is a technique for solving discrete partial differential equations, and it allows you to get a more efficient solution. In other words, the amount of computational resources that you have to employ to get a particular solution to within a particular level of accuracy, compared in particular to a unigrid type evolution. So when we finish describing the algorithm, I'll sort of give you a back of the envelope calculation on what kind of speed-ups one might expect. So it works very well for classes where you have a wide range of spatial temporal length scales. However, the spatial length scales aren't volume filling. If they're volume filling, then this algorithm just doesn't work. And so the idea is going to be that we have this broad range of length scales, but the small length scales only occupy a relatively small region of the computational domain. And for a given accuracy, you need a certain number of points per sort of wiggle of the piece of the solution that you're interested in. You have to resolve the features. And so if you have a small length scale, you need relatively high resolution at the length scale, and this adaptive mesh refinement is a method of doing that. So that's sort of the mesh refinement bit of it. The adaptive bit is, in particular for solutions where you don't beforehand know where those small length scales are going to be. If you do, say, for example, you're modeling a star, and you're modeling the oscillations of a star, but your boundary is a certain distance away. Well, you know exactly where the star is. It's not going to go anywhere. You can construct a non-uniform grid, for instance, to efficiently represent the star. Adaptive mesh refinement is useful in situations where you don't know beforehand where these small end scales are going to develop. Or, say, for example, with a binary black hole problem, you sort of know what they're going to do, but you don't know exactly. And so it's nice to have an algorithm that will automatically track evolving length scale features. And of course, in particular, these are for problems where it's too expensive to solve it on a uniform mesh. So just, you know, sort of a couple of points. You know, mesh refinement is a technique that gives you efficient solution to a certain class of problems. It doesn't give you more accuracy. In particular, if you just imagine, well, how much, if you've got a, especially compared to a unigrid evolution, there's, by definition, it can't give you more accuracy because it's only placing high resolution around those small length scale features. If you imagine a unigrid solution covering the entire domain, that's always going to give you a higher accuracy solution. The other thing that you have to worry about a little bit with adaptive mesh refinement are what happens at refinement boundaries. And typically, in, you know, sort of hand waving, you can think you've got an impedance mismatch. You've got resolution. You've got a solution with on one resolution that's abutting a solution at a lower or higher resolution. And typically, what happens is a couple of things. It could be sort of high frequency, you know, solutions that develop at those boundaries, in particular like corner regions, that's kind of common. So you get this noise that comes from the boundary. It's usually not at a very high level. It's quite low. And there could be sort of spurious reflections. You've got a wave that's traveling towards one of these refinement boundaries. A small piece of that could be reflected. And so in some sense, that you generically, those things are going to sort of, it's really difficult to eliminate those to a level where you can get a very high accuracy solution. So in some sense, you know, the way that I think of mesh refinement is if you're interested in a problem where you don't know what the answer is, and there's no way you can sort of tackle the problem using a unigrid code or some clever kind of coordinates which are sort of adapted to the problem, sort of AMR is a way in which you will get sort of the first order answer to the problem. So it's sort of like sort of exploring, you know, fundamental issues in physics sort of without, if you're not that interested in the most accurate solution. Yeah.
With high frequency solution noise you were talking about there, is that then proportional to the step in refinement, like how much the refinement increases at
it could be. So it's very rare that people do more than a 2-to-1 refinement ratio. So going sort of from one level to the next, increasing the resolution by more than 2-to-1. I don't think there's that much. The answer to your question is more empirical. You know, like when people have sort of, when look at high refinement ratios, that problem tends to be worse. But exactly how much worse? And
the reason why I ask is if you could go the other direction and like remove some grid points, but not all of them.
When I'll get to the boundaries, there is another approach that for certain equations can get rid of that, something that Luis proposed. And so I'll sort of, this Bergen allegory is sort of a more general approach, but with certain kinds of explicit schemes, in principle you can get rid of the reflections completely with, and I think that's perhaps what you're getting at, sort of a tapered boundary type approach. Yeah. So it's not that, I think like with certain problems you can work hard and you can get accurate solutions, you can, you know, as hard as you work, you can beat down the level of these noise sources that are introduced, but it's not. It's I think more it's a tool for efficiency rather than accuracy. Okay, so why is this mesh refinement important in general relativity? So as I discussed before, in particular if you think about 3D, say compact object mergers, we do have several orders of magnitude of relevant length scales that we have to resolve. With a binary black hole problem, you know, we've got the small length scales of black holes. Sort of an order of magnitude larger, we have the orbital motion, and then about an order of magnitude larger is the region where we can extract the gravitational waves, where it makes sense to define gravitational waves. So we do have this huge range of length scales that have to be resolved, and at least for the vacuum problem in this particular situation, they're not volume filling. So we have a huge computational domain, but we have sort of two regions where we need this high resolution. So that, I mean, that's, I'm saying, why is it beneficial to GR? But of course, there are situations where that's not going to be the case. And for example, I'm just mentioning generic cosmic singularities. So I never show this as an example, but an interesting property, one of the nature of singularities in GR is as you approach a singularity, you get the so-called chaotic mixed master behavior. And this is where you generally sort of get all of this very interesting structure on small scales that is essentially volume filling. And in such situations, mesh refinement is really, I mean, it will help a little bit, but it's not going to give you orders of magnitude as opposed to a situation like this. And of course, if you start including matter, and if the matter is dynamically important, in particular things like neutron stars or neutron star black hole systems, you're going to get tidal disruption of the matter, you could get turbulence. If you really want to resolve those features, then those are going to be volume filling. And mesh refinement will help, but it's not going to be as significant as it might be in the vacuum problem. I mean, that's why in astrophysical applications, many of these problems, like how well does, the magnetorotational instability work in driving accretion in a black hole system? That's not really a resolved question today, and partly because the simulations can't really, there's just not enough computational power to properly resolve the MRI in these situations. Okay, so the few other things, why adaptive? These are nonlinear equations. We don't necessarily know where the black holes are going to go. We can guess based on Keplerian, post-Keplerian, but we don't necessarily know. As I mentioned before, because in GR, the only scale in the problem is really the speed of light. It's really a scale-free theory. If you have a small length scale feature, you're going to have a correspondingly small time scale that you have to resolve, essentially because everything propagates at the speed of light. One comment is, as you saw from the in-spiral simulation, when the waves are generated, they aren't contained within a small lens. They propagate outwards, so they're volume filling. So if you wanted to accurately, with your mesh refinement, track, say, gravitational waves that are emitted, that's not going to work because the algorithm will naturally say, well, this is a volume filling feature and we have to resolve it. So in some sense, it's really the strong field, small scale features that we would need mesh refinement for. And for the gravitational waves, you pretty much have to just cover it with a uniform grid that's of sufficient resolution to get the wave to the accuracy that you want. And at least this is not such a, the gravitational waves, the typical wavelength are orbital frequencies, so it's not such a small frequency, yeah.
Just a simple question. So yeah. Does the time step change with the length step, or does the time step always remain at the maximum?
So with the Bergen-Ollig, it's going to change with the length step.
So and it's not only will you have smaller spaces, you'll actually have more steps.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'll show you that an explicit example. There are certain AMR algorithms where that's not the case, where there's a global uniform time step. And so if you do get small length scale features that need small time steps, that slows the whole thing down. But this Bergen-Ollig algorithm has sort of recursive time stepping, which automatically then decreases the time. So in some sense, at every point anywhere in the domain, you've got the same CFL condition. So you pick your CFL condition, and because of this recursive time subcycling, it will always maintain that CFL condition. So Courant, Fredericks, Louis. So did Matt not go over this? CFL? Right.
He used a different name.
Courant condition.
Courant condition, lambda.
Lambda.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Okay, so, I've said most of this. Okay, just a couple of things. So if we're just thinking about the binary black hole problem, I mean, some mesh refinement algorithms have very sophisticated grid structures that they can accommodate for. But if it's just going to be a couple of small length scale features, we don't really have to worry about it. And so a simple sort of box-in-box type approach works very well. The original Bergen-Ollig algorithm allowed grids to be rotated relative to the parent grid. So this will become a little bit more clear when I show you examples. And we don't really need that. And it turns out that really doesn't help you too much in terms of efficiency. I mean, there are algorithms that, for example, if you're interested in hydrodynamics, say you want to follow a shock wave that's got some interesting non-trivial topology, it's not, say, aligned with the grid. There are algorithms that will try to refine along outgoing shock waves and stuff. We're not going to be worrying about that here. As I mentioned, So adaptivity is important for us. So it doesn't help me pointing there. Adaptivity is important for us. This, we're going to maintain the same lambda, so time subcycling is important. We're not going to be able to do things like track volume filling features, but that's okay. At least in, luckily for gravitational waves, they're a relatively small part of the solution, and you, with a sufficient unigrid covering that, which isn't too computationally expensive, you can represent that. If you really want very high accurate gravitational waveforms, there are other ways in which you can handle that. For example, just use your regular AMR algorithm in the strong field regime. Then when the gravitational waves get to the weak field regime, say change to a spherical polar type coordinate system, which will be much more efficient at representing the waves, or perhaps try a different time slicing. So most of the codes are based on time slices that go to space like infinity. But the gravitational waves, of course, are traveling to null infinity, so if you can perhaps have hyperbolic or asymptotically null time slices, you'll also be able to, you'll be able to get around this problem. So, but for the moment, we're not going to work about, not going to worry about that. In any case, all of these considerations suggest that this Bergen-Ollinger algorithm, which I'll describe now, is really, is well suited towards this class of problems in GR. So this is the basic idea, and I'm saying this is sort of the simplified version, and then we, Matt and I sort of extended it to include hyperbolic equations. I'll just briefly outline how that goes. But this is essentially the Bergen-Ollinger algorithm, and it's simplified because we don't allow the subgrids to be rotated relative to parent grids. So the idea is this is our computational domain. This is, you know, the entire computational domain, and we're going to cover it with a hierarchy of grids. So the coarsest mesh is going to cover the entire domain. The next finer level resolution is always going to be contained within its parent level. So sort of a child level has higher resolution, a parent level has coarser resolution. So each child level is entirely contained within a parent, and there's some fixed refinement ratio as you go down in the hierarchy. The other thing that's sort of that's very useful with this Bergen-Ollinger style algorithm is in memory, each level is represented essentially independently from the parent level. So it's not that we've got some complicated data structure where we sort of cut out this piece of the parent and sort of somehow attach this the smoother level to it. In memory, the parent level is defined as a single uniform coarse grid. The second level down is defined as a set of as a list of uniform grids, etc. And the thing that's such so powerful about doing it this way is when you design your code for a particular problem, you really don't have to worry about the mesh refinement, the AMR algorithm at all. All that you have to do is you design a code that solves the problem on a uniform grid. And the only difference that you have to do, the only thing that you have to do that's different is you have to be aware of the fact that some of these boundaries might be interior boundaries. They're not your physical boundaries. So for example, in this case, on this grid, when you solve your equation, so you treat it exactly as a uniform problem, this will be a physical boundary. So whatever boundary condition you want to place here, that's the boundary condition that's associated with a physical problem, whether it's a Dirichlet, Neumann, a radiation condition, etc. Here, say on this little subgrid, you'll do exactly the same that you would do here on each interior point, but on the interior boundaries, you leave them alone, you don't touch them. And the algorithm will take care of the boundaries for you. So essentially, the only difference between writing a code for a unigrid problem and one that could be sort of incorporated into a Bergen-Ollinger framework is you just have to be aware of the boundaries. Yeah.
I'm just curious. In your picture, it looks like some of the higher level grids, the boundaries lie in between points on the coarser grids. Is that in general how it's implemented, or do you always have the boundaries line up so you can?
So the way that most, in general, you don't have to have them aligned up. I think the easiest thing is to have them aligned at least between adjacent levels. So I think you'd want, this example, I was sort of just more a cartoonish example. In principle, they don't have to line up. In practice, you at least want from one level to the next for them to be lined up. And actually for, If you're doing elliptic equations and you're solving it with multigrid, which we won't have time to discuss multigrid, With multi-grid, you really want them to be lined up all the way down. So you want them, that's a sort of a more stricter requirement on the alignment. And so that you don't have to do that, but it turns out that, so I don't know if you've, Matt didn't cover multi-grid at all, right? But so it's a technique where you can efficiently solve elliptic equations, and it works. Multi-grid is a very interesting algorithm. It's very finicky. You know, any little thing that you do wrong just breaks it completely. But once it goes, it's just amazing. You get incredibly efficient and quick solutions to elliptic equations. And one thing that seems to be finicky and breaks it if you don't quite align the levels up. But for hyperbolic equations, it makes it a bit easier, but it's not really essential. For example, the Bergmann-Orgel algorithm, as I said, allowed a child grid to be rotated at an arbitrary angle. I mean, the idea that they wanted is, say you've got like a wave that's propagating obliquely relative to the grid, well, it might be more efficient to have the child grid sort of aligned with the wave. Though for the kinds of problems that we're looking at, the extra efficiency you get is not worth all the extra work of the interpolation where you have to include rotations. So did you have a question?
Yes, I noticed here that two of your level two grids overlap.
Yeah.
Is that...
It's a little bit trickier to get that to work. And so, for example, in the PAMR, AMRD thing, at this stage, we don't allow overlap. So if they're distinct, that's fine. If they overlap, we just merge them into a single grid. And the only reason is that, you know, this noise that tends to happen, it tends to be much more difficult to control it at regions of overlap. But again, that's depending on your particular implementation. It's okay for grids to overlap. What will happen is, and we'll see this when I sort of go through. Well, we won't see the overlap issue, but you'll see there's a sort of synchronization stages in the algorithm. So one grid function is represented on many levels. And you might worry, well, what about single valuedness at certain points? But there are these synchronization stages that synchronize the values between the levels. And if they overlap, that will include the overlap regions. So that will be the, you know, you'll treat them as two different grid points, but then at one, after each step, they'll get synchronized and it will be a unique single value solution that you'll get. Yeah.
I guess if, suppose you have like a black hole that is moving toward the grids, right?
Yeah.
You want to have like the refinement of the mesh moving with the black hole.
Yeah.
Right, so you want to, I mean, how do you do this? You calculate like the barycenter of the energy?
There's several ways you can, in principle, do it. The way that Berger and Oliger does it, or the sort of suggested way, is using truncation error estimates. So what you do, and I'll show that in an example, is you, so you don't really, again, you're not necessarily aware of this AMR algorithm, or, you know, in the purely theoretical way of implementing this, you shouldn't be aware of the AMR algorithm, you're just aware of the boundaries. And what you supply as a parameter to the algorithm is the maximum truncation error that you want. And the way that it will do is it will compare solutions on different levels, by Richardson, the Richardson expansion, computer truncation error, and wherever that is above a certain threshold, it will say, okay, we need to have a level that covers that. And so that, in theory, should be able to automatically track a black hole. So a black hole, because it's a small length scale feature, the derivatives are going to be large. It's naturally there's going to be large truncation error about a black hole. So you have, say you have your black hole there, that moves to this point, then the algorithm will compute truncation errors and will notice, well, it's larger there than it used to be. And then say, well, okay, we have to move this grid. And when that works, that's really nice, because you don't have to do anything. You don't have to sort of understand features of the solutions just based on truncation error. Though in principle, you could say, if you want to specifically track the black holes, or you want to make sure that there's, you can custom design ways that sort of tell it how to refine the meshes as you go along. In particular, that might be important for if you include hydrodynamics, because using the Richardson expansion assumes solutions are smooth. You don't have any shocks, and if you have shocks, that what might happen if you're not careful with that is it will produce a sort of infinite cascade of refinement. It will try to completely refine the shock until you run out of levels. Right? There'll be some maximum level, and you might not want to do that. And so then there might be some other criteria that you want to do for things like that. Okay. Okay. So this is the way that you sort of cover your computational domain. So a couple of sort of features of the algorithm. I'll sort of explain them in words, and then we'll do a graphic example that might clarify it. So there's a recursive time stepping algorithm. That's done for a couple of reasons. That's essentially the primary reason is so that you can this algorithm can generically provide initial data for these sublevels. So I said, you know what the boundary conditions are here. This is your physical boundary. But this is at an interior level. You don't know what the boundary conditions are. So the way that the algorithm proceeds is you take a step on the parent grid. So then your parent grid, you know it at the sort of, you know what the solution is on this grid at the future time. So you know what it is, say, at the boundary of this child grid. Then you use interpolation in time on the parent to set the boundary conditions for the child level. And then after you've set, so now you know what the boundary conditions are, then you take a set of sub-steps on your child level. Right, so, now perhaps after I show you the algorithm, I'll say, okay, that's for a general system of PDE, so whether it's implicit or explicit, whether you solve it using iterative methods or not, such a technique would be able to handle those kinds of boundaries. But if you have an explicit integration in time, there's an alternative way, like this tapered grid where, the recursive time stepping procedure is still sort of a useful way of implementing the algorithm. It's not strictly necessary then, but I'll sort of just go over that a little bit towards the end. As I mentioned, the nice thing about the way that the algorithm proceeds then, the interpolation in time, that is independent of the PDEs that you're solving. So from the point of view of you writing a code that's AMR compatible, you don't really have to know anything about the details of how it's implementing the AMR, how it's doing the mechanics of this. All you have to do is write your Unigrid code and just essentially have a flag that the AMR algorithm will pass you and say, this boundary is physical, you have to do something, or this boundary is interior, just leave it alone. So you take your step on your coarse level, you take sub-steps on your fine level. When they're in sync again, then you inject the solution from the child level, which is the higher resolution, more accurately known solution, back up to the parent level. Let's see, where's the... Okay, so the other thing that I also mentioned a little bit about this, the way that it constructs the hierarchy is by doing Richardson extrapolations. And in the original Berger and Olger proposal, what would happen is that you evolve for a certain amount of time on a fixed hierarchy, and then you stop and say, well, it's now time to what they call regrid, and essentially like do this Richardson expansion computation, like seeing, is this hierarchy adequately capturing the small solution scale features? And so the way that they suggested was, they say make a 2-to-1 coarse inversion of the entire hierarchy, take one step on that, take a couple of steps on the original hierarchy, and then do this Richardson subtraction, you'll get an estimate of the truncation error. However, because of the recursive time subcycling, you can really do that sort of in situ. You don't have to actually make copies of the hierarchy. And that's something called sort of a self-shadow hierarchy. The hierarchy casts its own shadow, sort of in a colloquial sense. I'll show you sort of an example of that. And so that's a really convenient way, if you were to write your own AMR algorithm, how to compute these truncation errors. And the only thing that you really need to is to sort of bootstrap it by having the first coarsest level be fully refined. So you actually have two coarse levels that are the first two levels cover your entire computational domain. Another way of thinking of it is what you really want as your coarsest level is actually the second level in the hierarchy. Okay, so before I show the example, let me just, one reason why you can do the subcycling and why, so you can use the parent level to put boundary conditions on a child level for hyperbolic equations is because of finite speed of propagation. So if this is your coarse level, and say you've got your the wave that needs a lot of resolution. And so you've got your fine grid that's covering this wave. So on the coarse grid, you know, in memory, you've just got the single coarse grid, and this thing is going to be very poorly represented, right? So just imagine. So the fine grid accurately resolves what the coarse grid doesn't. So now you take a step of the coarse grid, you're going to get the solution there completely wrong. But it's a hyperbolic equation, so there's only so far that this crap in the center can propagate in one time step. And the idea is if you've generated this hierarchy, by truncation errors, there's going to be a buffer zone. You're going to place a certain buffer zone between the high resolution bit and the boundary on the coarse level. Because the assumption is where only the coarse level is, you have adequate resolution. So the solution is going to be completely wrong here, but you're only going to it's only going to be able to propagate by the causal speed, how fast things can propagate in one time step. So in the region where the child boundary is, here you know the solution pretty accurately, at least within your truncation error. So in this region, it makes sense to be able to interpolate in time to set boundary conditions for this, for the coarse level. So you take one step, the solution there is junk, the solution's okay here, you interpolate in time, now you take the solution on the coarse level, so you get the accurate behavior of this wave, and then you inject it back to the coarse level. So you keep on replacing this solution with the more accurate solution on the coarse level. And so the hyperbolic nature of equations allows this recursive time stepping to work. But now imagine you solve an elliptic equation, and you want to just verbatim apply the same algorithm. So in elliptic equations, that's no longer true. Right, so in elliptic equations, the solution is essentially entirely determined by the boundary conditions and whatever sources you have that are acting on the problem. So, say in a Poisson-type equation, where the energy in this wave is going to act as a source for the potential. If you then say, well, okay, let's solve an elliptic equation now just on the coarse level, but the sources are poorly resolved, it's going to globally change the entire solution. It's not protected by this finite causal speed, and so you can't use a pure coarse level solution to set boundary conditions for like a sort of an interior Laplace, an elliptic type solution. And so I don't want to go sort of into the details, but the way you can sort of get around it is you don't solve the elliptic equations sort of descending this. So with this recursive time-stepping algorithm, you can think of it as you descend this recursive, you're descending a tree-like data structure. So when you go down the tree, you're taking levels on coarse, you're taking steps on coarse levels, and when you ascend the tree again, you're injecting the solution back up to, so you go down to finer levels, you get the solution, and then you inject it back up to coarse levels. So when you descend the tree, you solve the hyperbolic equations, but you don't solve the elliptics. You just use an extrapolated guess. And then when you ascend the tree and you inject, then you've evolved this to some point, you inject the solution back, and then you solve the elliptic equations over an entire subdomain where the problem's in sync. Sorry, that was a very, very confused description. I think it will be a little bit easier when I show you sort of graphically what's happening, but... Okay, so here's sort of the graphic example. So what I'm showing here is the 2D example, and this is going to be time. So this is t equals 0. We want to evolve this thing up here to t equals whatever. This is our 2D grid. And in this example, we have two initial levels in the hierarchy. And so if we're using a self-shadow hierarchy, actually three levels. So this base level is fully refined, and because it's fully refined, there's a coarser level sitting on top of this, and that allowed us to say, okay, we need more resolution here in the center. So we want to evolve this with this time subcycling structure. In this example, the refinement ratio is 2:1, and so to keep the same CFL, the same lambda, the temporal refinement ratio has to be 2:1 as well. So you'll see that the first step, then, we take one step on the coarse level, we go up to here. As you can see here, it hasn't resolved this wave adequately at all. The solution there is not going to be quite right, but it's not going to propagate that far. It's sort of in this region, nothing much is happening. And so presumably this is a good approximation to the full solution. So now we've taken sort of one time step on the coarse level. And now we can, so if you want to evolve this with the same CFL factor, we have to take two time steps on the fine level. So at this intermediate time step, we can interpolate between the solutions on this coarse level to find the boundary conditions for this fine grid evolution. And so we're going to take one time step on the fine grid, a second time step. And now at this stage, so this is sort of where this so-called self-shadow hierarchy comes into play. So at this stage, now we've got the solution isn't single valued, right? We've taken a solution on the coarse step, the truncation error is going to be different. We've taken two solutions on the fine level, they're going to differ by the truncation error. So at this stage, we can now subtract the solutions in this region, get an estimate of the truncation error, and that will tell us, do we need to refine or not? So before the injection phase of the algorithm, before we make the grid function single valued again, essentially before we copy from the fine to the coarse, we compute the truncation error and save it. So just going back one step. So here, so the hyperbolic equations we would have solved to this point. The elliptics we would not have solved them. We'd solve them over the we'd use sort of an extrapolated solution for the elliptic equations as sort of as a temporary step. Now at this phase, we compute the truncation error, and now we're going to inject the solution. So now we inject the solution from the fine to the coarse, and we've got a single-valued function throughout. And now at this stage, we resolve the elliptic equations over the entire grid. And so now we know that, so everything is in sync up to this point, so we solve the entire, these sources are adequately resolved within the multigrid algorithm. And sorry, I mean, we didn't have time to go over multigrid, but multigrid also sort of works on a hierarchy of meshes, so this very naturally fits into a multigrid solution of elliptics. So now, okay, we are halfway through the evolution. Now suppose we computed the truncation error there and we found, okay, we weren't adequately resolving this piece of the solution, or now the errors have grown to the point where now we're just above the threshold at this point. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you have like a reflection of the waves?
You'll have.
There should be like a kind of potential.
Yeah, so you will have small reflections. So that's one problem that I mentioned with this kind of algorithm. There will be small reflections. So the main features of solutions. So if this is sort of the main feature that you're solving, if you set up the algorithm correctly, you set your truncation error thresholds correctly, it will always track this feature around. So this feature will never sort of go half, it will never be halfway between levels. But in something like GR, this might be the black hole, but it's going to be radiating. You don't have the resources to track the radiation, so they will cross the domain. If your truncation error parameters are fine, if the radiation isn't too high frequency relative, or small wavelength relative to the meshes, most of it will pass as it should be, but there will always be a small reflective component with this algorithm of interpolating from the parents. So that's something. One thing that actually helps a little bit with those things are Berger and Oliger style dissipation. Because often, just some part of the reflected component is going to be the characteristic wavelength of the wave. And Berger and Oliger doesn't target that unless it's below the threshold. But there's also going to be some noise that's developed at these boundaries. And once it propagates inwards, Kreis-Oliger style dissipation is very effective at getting rid of some of that noise. Okay, so now suppose we wanted a new level. When you introduce a new refinement level, you initialize the data by interpolation from the parent level. So of course, this is not necessarily going to be a more accurate solution because you don't know what the solution should have been at such a fine level. But if you have a higher order interpolation scheme, at least it will be smooth. And so sort of the idea is if you, let's say we've got, say imagine this were like a gravitational collapse situation. So what, if you say plot a truncation error across the grid, or the truncation error estimate, in this, and this is your threshold. So you never want the truncation error to go above this threshold. Now, with time, so you know, it might be something like that. So here it was, so going backwards in time, it was sufficiently below the truncation error. So you know, now this thing is collapsing, the truncation error is growing. And what you want to do, you want to refine sufficiently often that you never get to a situation where the truncation error is huge when you introduce a new level, because then you're not really reducing the error in your solution, you're just covering it with a finer mesh. But then if you select the parameters correctly, what you want to do is you want to capture the point just as it goes above this threshold and say, okay, things are starting to be poorly resolved, let's refine this region now with a higher grid. And so you sort of globally maintain the same error in the solution if you properly refine. I mean, there's a little bit of an art to this, because another thing you don't want to do is you don't want to refine too often. Because refinement, especially like if the grids move around, interpolation introduces noise, quotes noise, but high frequency solution components. So that what you typically do is, it's like if this happens, you don't refine like this. You will add a buffer zone to it and refine like this, assuming that, okay, it's going to be growing in this region, but say the buffer zone will allow you to refine less frequently.
Do you authorize a technique where when your threshold is reached for refinement, that you refine at a previous time step so that you don't?
So that's, in some sense, that would be the ideal way to go about doing that. The reason why it's impractical is you have to save past time level information.
But I mean, since you're presumably outputting them in the waveform actually.
Yeah, the thing is it can be very computationally expensive to do that. So in terms of, so like with something like an Einstein equation thing where, you know, you might be, on each of your nodes, even in a parallel distribution, you might be using 20, 30, 40, 50% of the memory. And that's just to represent, say, the two time levels, this one and time plus one. Each past time level that you represent essentially doubles the amount of memory. So you can do that to a small extent. But so the thing is, like, the truncation error is not going to grow very rapidly from one time step. It's going to grow on like a physical time scale. So if you know something that's undergoing gravitational collapse, you know, some fraction of the ADA mass of the time, it might go to a point where it's above threshold. But because of your CFL conditions based on the speed of light, that might be 20, 30, 40 time steps, you know, where it goes from this level to this level. So if you wanted to back it up, say, to 10% of what the truncation error was, that would imply you have to go quite far back in time. So I know that there are you know, codes that, at least in the computer science literature, they do that, but they're more theoretical. I mean, the practical issues in a real complicated or a computationally intensive simulation of saving the past time levels makes it really difficult to do that. And that would be the ideal, but unfortunately it doesn't work. So one thing that you can sort of say is, well, okay, you know, because we're not doing that, well, let's set our truncation error. This is sort of our accurate, we want the solution, but let's set the truncation error a little bit smaller than that. So we sort of try to catch it before it happens. And again, if you play around with the parameters properly, things will work reasonably well. Okay, so let's just now sort of complete this example. Okay, so now we've got a third level. So now this recursive time stepping proceeds. So we've now refined. Now we're going to take again. We're going to take a time step on the coarsest level. Now recursively, now we're going to take two time steps on this one, but the algorithm is recursive, right? So we take the first one of those two steps. But now we realize, okay, there's a finer level there. So we're first going to take the two steps on those levels. And again, now interpolating in time to set the boundaries. So we take those two time steps. We can compute truncation errors there if we want, synchronize them. Let's just say, okay, this is fine. We don't need any finer levels. So now then we can repeat the algorithm. Take the second step on level two, inject, take this the final two steps on the third level and inject. So sort of in a graphic way, this is the way, so this will be your grid structure in space and time for one of these Bergen-Olgel type hierarchy. And so you can perhaps imagine if you wanted to do this on a unigrid that had this resolution, right? It would cover the entire domain and you'd have this many steps. So sort of you can see how much of this volume is filled up by the mesh is roughly how much you're going to be saving in terms of computational cost with this kind of algorithm. So any questions about this recursive time stepping? Okay. So, right here, this is just sort of like a little back of the order envelope calculation on how much you might save. So let's imagine we have a D plus one dimensional system, so 3 plus 1. So D is a number of spatial dimensions. So on the coarsest level, we have n points in each dimension. So we have a total of n to the D points. Let's assume a spatial refinement ratio of 2 to 1. We have L levels of refinement. And we're going to take n time steps on the coarsest level. So we're going to assume a temporal refinement ratio of 2 to 1 as well. So that will require, n to the 2 little L minus 1 time steps on level L. So we imagine we've got this kind of hierarchy. And let's just assume that the linear filling factor is a half. So each linear dimension on a finer level is half the size on the parent level. So we've got the sequence of hierarchies, and we imagine we have 11 of them. We're also going to assume that the runtime is just proportional to the total number of grid points that we have. And for sort of any explicit run cutter type algorithm, if you have an implicit one, it's roughly the same number of iterations on each level, then to a good approximation, that's really, it doesn't matter if it's unigrid or AMR. It's going to be proportional to the number of points. And so we just want to compare the total runtime in an AMR algorithm like this compared to a putative unigrid algorithm where we cover the entire mesh with a resolution of the finest grid. And so let's sort of see be the average cost in evaluating the equations for one grid point. So perhaps the unigrid one's the easiest. So we have n to the d points times n time steps that we have to take. And that's, because we're covering the entire grid with the finest level, it's n times 2 to the power L minus 1 to the power d times n time steps, so times this time step. So this is the computational cost, roughly, that you would expect with the unigrid code. With the AMR code, each level only has the same number of grid points n to the d because we've chosen a volume filling factor of a half to sort of simplify the problem. But then each level is going to have n, but times the spatial, so the temporal refinement ratio, number of time steps. So these are the number of spatial points times the number of time steps. And this is just sort of approximately equal to this. So we take the ratio, and you can see that the amount of time that the unigrid code will take is more by this particular factor. And this can be used, for example, sorry. Yeah. So you could make a more complicated calculation if you want to. So in the limit where the filling factor there was one, this would probably be a factor of d times L times slower because you've got L levels. If it's a smaller filling factor, it would even be more efficient. But I'm just and then, so like with the binary black hole problem, this typically it seems to be about roughly on the order of a half, I just want sort of like a relatively simple example to show, because like the one thing that you can see how you could get such a huge, how things can be so much more efficient is this sort of what Matt calls the curse of dimensionality, right? If you're in a high dimensional simulation, it's not just that, the number it scales linearly with the dimension, it's 2 to the power dimension just because of the way that you refine it. And so now So this is where the 2 to the d power comes from. And if we have L levels, it's 2 to the d times L. So imagine like 10 refinement levels in 3 dimensions. There's 2 to the power 30. And this might sound outrageous, but it really isn't. I mean, that's, for example, why critical phenomena wasn't discovered before. apparently Svi Piran and someone else back in the 80s also tried to look at scalar field collapse, and they just completely missed it because they couldn't resolve this small length scale feature that was developing. And so even though that was a one-dimensional simulation, d equals 1. So actually, I think Matt used 5-to-1 refinement. So that was one of the... I don't know why 5-to-1. He experimented with a whole bunch of ranges, but he found 5-to-1 worked. And in 1D, you can imagine it might be easier to control reflections and spurious effects. You've only got one boundary to deal with. But he used 5-to-1 refinement, you know, because of this each echo is a 30th the length scale of the previous one. You really needed you need A more in that situation. And in higher dimensions, it's essential. Okay, sorry. Let me see what else did I want to say. Never mind. So we don't have time to go into the PAMR stuff. I just want to. That's just one package. I mean, there's Paramesh, there's, there are dozens. You can look at it online. Luis has a package had that he has seen leaving and them have done. I just want to mention this alternative tapered method, because that's very useful. If you have an explicit type time integration. So this the idea is, let's just do a one-dimensional example. So here we have time, and here we have our two levels. So this is our coarse level. Sorry, this is our coarse level, and this is our fine level. And I mean, in general, there are going to be issues with reflections and stuff from the boundaries. So, all right, we take our step on the coarse level. We take our two time steps. But then the idea with this tapered method is, if you have an explicit scheme, there's sort of a numerical speed of propagation. Where in, say, it's a second-order round cutter or a fourth-order round cutter, there's only... So what you do in this method is you treat the boundary conditions as... or the boundaries as garbage, right? So you say, we don't know what these boundaries are. Interpolation isn't going to really do anything better. So just treat them as garbage. But so this... when you take this time step, you know, say, you've got all your mesh points here, you know, based on your discretization stencil, this is going to depend on a couple of adjacent mesh points. So essentially, say a second order round cutter, you sort of take an intermediate step before you get to this one. In some sense, this point after this first intermediate step is contaminated, so this is the bad point. So now you've contaminated this point. Then you take this step, so you've contaminated these three points, and et cetera. And say by this time, okay, I'm exaggerating, by the time you get to here, say you've contaminated 5 points. What you then just do is you just throw away those solutions from the coarse grid. From the fine grid. You just say, okay, they're gone. We're not going to worry about them at all. And then just reinterpolate from the parent mesh onto that part of the coarse grid. So in that sort of, you're not really literally cutting and truncating grids, but essentially what the grid structure that you evolve looks like. So let's say this is the coarse level. So this is sort of the numerical speed of propagation. This will be your fine level. But this part you say is junk, so you throw it away, you reinterpolate to this level, and so your fine mesh will have sort of this Christmas tree type structure, sort of a tapered mesh. So essentially what you're just doing is you're saying, we're not trusting this Burgo and Olliger style interpolation to give us an accurate solution. We can just reinterpolate from the parent level. And that, I think, works very well for these explicit type methods. So the cost you pay is that your domain has to be larger by this particular size. And for example, with fourth order, sixth order round cutter, this could be huge. And especially in 3D, then that's a huge volume of the grid that you have to throw away. And it also doesn't work for something like an implicit scheme, which is taking an arbitrary number of iterations in principle, like as you'll see with this Tsiolkovsky equation. In some cases, if you specify a tolerance that's too small, it could take 15, 20 time steps, which means that the piece of your domain that's contaminated, it could fill your entire volume. So that won't work with those situations. But if you have something where it does work, I think in some sense, that solves the problem of boundary reflections and relatively efficiently. So, Okay, I just wanted to see if there's anything. The sort of final comment, so we didn't really go into elliptic equations, but especially, you know, for some reason in the numerical relativity community, it's sort of probably still persists today, this notion that you want to avoid elliptic equations. Either if you want to do a partially constrained evolution, or perhaps it's an elliptic gauge condition. You have a nice gauge condition, which is naturally comes up as an elliptic equation. And there's often this notion, well, elliptic equations are really slow to solve in comparison to hyperbolic. And the one comment is, with multigrid, that's not the case. It's perhaps a factor of two slower, but it scales with a number of points just like the hyperbolic equations. I think this notion that elliptics are slow only is if you use a stupid way to solve elliptic equations, like relaxation or something like that. And then it really does scale like somehow at power of the grid points. And so if you go to three dimensions, you'll be killing yourself if you solve elliptic equations. But with multigrid, it's going to be of order the same amount of time as the hyperbolic. So don't be afraid of elliptic equations. And multigrid's the answer. Okay, so I guess then today there's another tutorial session. So probably some of you are going to be still focusing on Berger's equation, the ultra-relativistic, and perhaps some will be doing it, the Tucholsky equation. Any questions about this stuff? Or okay, thank you. 谢谢。